bought for me, whisking it up.
Looks great on.
Tugs it over my head.
Looks even better off.
He drags his teeth over his bottom lip as he roams those sinful brown eyes over me. I shiver under his hot stare. That seems to excite him, my reaction, judging from the hiss in his breath, the heat in his irises, the bulge in his jeans.
Josie, Josie, Josie.
He repeats, shaking his head in admiration. Then he's all determination and desire as he kisses me thoroughly, starting at my belly button, traveling up my stomach, stopping to lift his face and say,
"Yeah, drives me crazier."
I smile, then sigh happily as he pays a visit to my tits, then frees them.
"Perfect."
He murmurs as he cups my tits, then buries his face between them, but he doesn't stay there long. He moves to my right breast, flicking a delicious circle around the nipple, then drawing it into his mouth, then nipping me lightly. "Oh, God," I say, but it's more like a half moan, half yelp.
"You like that?"
It's less a question, more a statement. "I think I'm into it," I tease.
"Let's be sure,"
he says, then bites a little harder. I arch into him in answer. He moves to the other one. And yes, I'm very into having my tits played with, as it turns out. And he's into playing with them. He squeezes and kneads, sucks and kisses, then lets out a long, hungry rumble.
"Fuck. You taste good. Everywhere,"
he says as he rises up and meets my face. His gaze is borderline feral, and I love it. But he's wearing too many clothes. He's too sexy to be clothed. "I wonder if you do too," I say, then I push up, ready to discover.
"Find out,"
he says. In no time, I'm unbuttoning his shirt and he's shrugging it off. And holy fucking hell, his muscles have muscles. His biceps are ripped. His abs are illegal. A blue bruise decorates the side of his stomach and a small scar travels across his right wrist. "I bet you didn't get this falling off a bike," I say of the scar. With a laugh, he shakes his head, then lets me explore him more. The best part? The ink that crawls down his arms, sunbursts on his shoulders and biceps, a couple music notes on his forearms, and a line drawing of a cute dog on his wrist. The silver chain I was drawn to earlier gleams around his neck, thick links resting against his skin. I can finally find out how he tastes right there, and the prospect makes me giddy. My hands journey across his pecs and up over his collarbone, my fingertips playing with the cool metal against his skin. I lean in and press my lips to his throat. He growls, a low sound as I savor the woodsy clean scent, like the forest trees from my hometown in Maine, like a mountain stream, like a stranger who saved me tonight. I lean back and stare a little longer. My eyes have never feasted so well. "Where did you get this body? Did you order it from the Department of Abs and Pecs?" His smile is pleased, a bit proud, but not cocky.
"I work out a little,"
he says dryly. "Liar," I say as I run my nails down his sturdy pecs, carved from, I don't know, titanium maybe. I travel down to his abs. "I mean, you've never skipped core day."
"True,"
he admits. "And these arms," I say, exploring them from forearm to shoulder. My jaw might be on the floor. It's possible I'm drooling. "I'm sorry, but I'm totally objectifying you right now."
"I'm not sorry, but fair warning, in about 1 minute, I'm going to tear off those panties, spread your thighs, and taste what I've done to you tonight."
I know what I'm into now, his mouth. "First, can I objectify your cock with my mouth?" Dragging a hand through his hair in slow-mo, he stares like he can't quite believe he found me outside a gallery dressed in slippers and a t-shirt, and like he can't believe his luck. He bends, cups my cheeks, and presses a hot kiss to my lips.
"Yes."
I'm not sure who's inhabiting my body tonight. I'm not sure I've ever felt this forward, but I am sure I've never been this turned on, this excited. In no time, he sheds his jeans and his boxer briefs, freeing his cock. It's as sexy as the rest of him, thick, hard, and with a drop of liquid arousal beating at the tip. I push him down on the bed and climb over him. Then right when I'm about to have some fun with his dick, I remember my glasses. I pop up, Just a sec. I crawl across the bed to set them down on the nightstand, then he tackles me by the waist.
Can't stand these clothes a second longer,
he says. Then he's flipping me onto my back and undressing me, skimming my pants down my legs, then my undies. Everything's happening so quickly, and for a few seconds, I'm no longer the bold girl. I'm vulnerable, completely naked in a hotel room with a stranger. A sexy stranger, but still a stranger. A stranger who's... Oh God. Oh my. Oh fuck. Wesley's objectifying me right now, with his talented mouth, with his wicked lips, with his fantastic tongue. The man has slid between my thighs and is spreading me open. He's groaning and sighing, flicking his tongue up and down my center, then sucking on my clit. He laps me up as he glides his big hands under me, scooping me up, squeezing my ass, bringing me even closer to his mouth. I feel like his dessert, like I'm the ice cream porn he was really craving all day, like the hand dipper date was part of the foreplay. For a second, he stops.
Put your hands in my hair. It's more fun that way. You can control the pace,
he says. Oh, right. Good idea. I slide my fingers through his strands and jerk him close. He rumbles against my pussy, then blows on it. I suck in a breath that turns into flames inside me. His mouth is back on me in seconds, and he eats me thoroughly. I'm tugging on his hair as he's squeezing my ass. He kisses and sucks and worships, and it's so decadent. It doesn't take long at all till I'm rocking against his scruffy jaw, then gasping, crying, screaming. I come hard and fast and loud, so loud that when he finally stops, he's chuckling.
I'm going to need to hear that again. It's good for my ego,
he says. And my pussy, I say, still catching my breath. His smile burns off.
That's it.
He reaches for my hand and tugs me up and off the bed. My feet hit the floor.
Time to fuck you hard.
I frown. Isn't it my turn to objectify you? But he's no longer in the mood to indulge me, it seems, since he spins me around and bends me over the mattress.
Hands on the bed. Ass in the air,
he instructs. Something in his voice has me scrambling. My generous, helpful knight in shining armor is a little rough in bed, a lot dirty. He presses a big hand to the small of my back, pushing me down. A flame sparks higher in me, then hotter when he grabs my ass cheeks and squeezes them appreciatively.
The things I want to do.
Is Wesley an ass man? Am I an ass woman? I don't even know, but my body likes whatever he's doing to me since my bones are dissolving. But he lets go, bends over, pushes my hair to the side.
Be right back.
What? Where?
Stay here.
I wasn't going anywhere. Curiosity has got a hold of me, so I crane my neck and watch him retreat. And yep, I'm an ass woman. That is one fine backside, firm and big. He strides into the bathroom. A second later, water streams into the sink, then stops. He returns, roots around in his jeans, and brings out his wallet. Then he fishes out a condom and meets my gaze.
You like watching me, don't you?
He asks with a cocky rise in his lips. I do, I admit, my eyes locked on him. He holds the condom in one hand, then drops the other to his cock, gives it a stroke. I swallow. His lips curve up. He gives it a rougher tug. I clench my thighs.
Bet you'd watch me if you saw me jerking it to you.
It feels like a filthy game we're playing, like we're testing out scenarios in our one night. Bet you'd do the same, I taunt. His smile is full of wicked approval. He gives another shuttle of his fist till he's squeezing out a drop of pre-cum from the head of his cock. I squirm. He reaches closer, offers it to me.
Suck it off,
he says, a clear order. And yes, I'm into that too. I part my lips and he slides his thumb into my mouth. He tastes like clean hands. He washed his hands before he put a finger in my mouth. That's some swoon-worthy attention to detail. I close my eyes and moan around his finger.
Show me,
he says,
how you wanted to suck my cock.
This man keeps me on my toes. I open wider, saying, more. He gives me another finger, and I suck harder on both. He groans, and I shudder. After a few more seconds, he eases out, smacks my ass lightly, then rolls on the condom. Nudging my legs a little wider, he notches the head of his cock against me, then sinks in. I bow my back, grip the covers, moan.
Yes.
He murmurs as he pauses, takes a beat. Then he sinks all the way in, filling me up. I'm stretched. The pressure is intense, but so is the crackle of pleasure, the sharp, hot jolts that rush through me. Slowly, like a tease, he eases out almost all the way, leaving me wanting more. But he doesn't give it to me. He takes his sweet time, fucking into me slowly, inch by inch, then easing out. After he's done that 4 or 5 times, I'm panting and begging. Wesley, I moan, needy.
Yes, baby.
Harder, I demand.
Oh, that's right. You wanted a good, hard fucking tonight.
He says, then he slams into me. I cry out from the intensity. Oh, fuck. He stills.
Okay.
That was a good oh, fuck, I say, my breath already shallow. He grips my ass tighter and drives into me, his hips flush against mine, then eases out again, making me ache for more, making me beg. Please, I gasp. He sinks into me again, filling me till there's no room left. Then he covers me with his body, his chest to my back, his arm banding around my tits, his mouth against my neck, his teeth nipping at my flesh. It's intimate, the way he's holding me, and aggressive, the way he's using me. I feel held and used all at once, and it's so damn good. This is a kind of hard, rough sex I didn't know I was into, but it turns out I am. I'm clawing at the sheets as he pounds into me. I'm moaning and gasping. He's grunting and cursing. My cells light up with each thrust. When I'm close, obviously close, he lets go of my tits, moves that hand up the back of my neck and into my hair. He tugs on some strands, and that's it. It sends me over the cliff. My brain blanks out. It goes offline as my body shakes. The orgasm hurtles through me, a burst of pleasure and light and fire. I'm calling his name as he drives into me, then stills, jerks, and groans for days. Another slow pump, another moan. Then he slumps over me, brushes my hair from my neck, and presses a tender kiss there. He's somehow filthy and sweet, and the way he fucks me is the best welcome to San Francisco ever. A little later, we're cleaned up and in bed, flicking through the channels, but finding nothing exciting to watch. Since, well, it's regular TV. I'm not sure how this works, hotel sex. Do we stay the night? It's not even midnight. It's 11. And the day feels like it's been 96 hours long, and I'm tired, but I haven't had dinner, even though the ice cream was real good. My stomach speaks up, growling. Rude bitch. He laughs.
You hungry, Josie?
That's a yes.
Let's get some food.
I frown. Do I have to get dressed? He scoffs.
No way.
Soon, we're dining on sushi in bed from a nearby restaurant, and he's telling me about his favorite cafes in the city and the best place to get a latte, and I tell him about the places I want to see. But we don't trade numbers or last names. We don't say, I'd love to see you again, and we don't make plans. Still, there's one very important thing I want to say. My aunt gave me a list of the top things she's never regretted, and since I've finally started tackling the items on the list and making them my own, it seems right to let number one know how I feel. I draw a soldiering breath, then say, that thing I wanted to do? He adopts a perplexed look.
What would that be?
I swat his biceps. Have a one-night stand with a sexy stranger.
Ah, that thing. Yes, I recall it now.
He's making this so easy. Still, it feels important to get this right. When someone you love gives you instructions before they go, it seems like you should handle them with care. Wesley's part of the list now, part of this new history of me, the first checkmark. So I meet his eyes and say, I'm glad it was you. He dips his face, smiling. When he lifts it, he locks his gaze with mine again, then says,
Me too.
There's an intensity in those warm, soulful eyes that makes my stomach flip, that makes me wonder what it would be like if he was more than a stranger. Briefly, I toy with the idea of asking if he wants to hang out. But there's no item on Aunt Greta's list or mine for anything more than one night. My new job starts in 2 more days, on Tuesday. My new life. Best to be true to the plan. We're both quiet for a beat, and maybe he's unsure of what happens next when he says,
"So the night ended better than it began?"
"It really did," I say. Then I yawn, fighting to stay awake.
"Go to sleep,"
he says on a yawn too.
"Sleep makes a perfect one-night stand even more perfect."
I take off my glasses again. We dim the lights, slide under the covers, and crash into slumber. I'm dead to the world until I get up to pee early in the morning. When I trudge back to bed, I fumble around for my phone to check the time and squint at the screen. Christian:
"Get ready to be an aunt. Liv is in labor for real, and the babies are almost here."
Then he sends me the address to the hospital. I bolt upright, wide awake despite the fact it's 5 a.m. In a flurry, I jam on my glasses, yank on clothes, find a tube of toothpaste and smear some on my teeth, then hunt for a pad of paper. Finding one, I scribble out a note thanking Wesley. Then I go, leaving him behind and taking the sexiest memory of my life with me into the early dawn.
Chapter 7. Glass Scarf. Wesley. The fading scent of cinnamon drifts past my nose. That's a real nice way to wake up. But there are even better ways to rise. I stretch an arm across the bed, reaching for Josie. She's adventurous. Maybe she'll be up for one more round. "Hey," I murmur, my voice gravelly from the last remnants of sleep. She doesn't answer. The room's quiet. My hand makes contact with a pillow. My eyes float open. Pushing up on my elbows, I tilt my head, listening for any sounds of a shower, perhaps. It's dead silent. My shoulders slump. But I'm a glutton for punishment, since I swing my legs out of bed and pad to the bathroom, just in case she's, I don't know, quietly applying hotel lotion. But it's empty too. I take care of business, then hunt around the room for my clothes. I pull on my boxer briefs before sitting on the end of the bed, more contemplative than I like to be first thing in the morning. Or, really, ever. I drag a hand through my messy hair, missing Josie's hands in it, making it messier. Fact is, I wasn't just hoping for another round with her. I was hoping to get her number, to ask her to hang out again. Sure, we said it was a one-night stand, but some one-night stands should turn into two nights. Or three. I've been planning to suggest as much when we woke up. It's been a while since I met someone I clicked with so easily. Someone who wasn't into me for the number on my back. Or on the flip side, someone who didn't hate what it represented. Though hate may be a strong word for my ex's feelings about hockey. Anna looked down on it turns out. And me. "You need a life beyond hockey. The sport won't last forever, you know," she'd said. "Really? It won't?" "But you don't like anything besides hockey," she'd said. "You never want to discuss the world or ideas. You don't even read the articles and think pieces I send you." No shit. I'd rather take a puck to the chin than read a fucking essay. And this trip down romance memory lane was brought to you by the one-night stand that ended too soon. But it's for the best. Just because Josie and I had one great night doesn't mean we'd vibe beyond ice cream in the bedroom and random conversations that were, let's face it, easy to have, given how we met. It's not hard to talk to someone who's wearing next to nothing as she bargains to gain entrance to a snooty art gallery. Besides, my ex wasn't all wrong. Hockey is my life. I eat, breathe, and sleep it when the season starts, and that's what's happening in a few more days. Resigned to not seeing Josie again, I push up from the bed, get dressed, and return to the bathroom to scrub some toothpaste on my teeth. After, I splash water on my face. That done, I return to the room, looking for my wallet when I catch sight of a white notepad by the entrance to the room. Huh. I head over to it. The notepad is propped up next to the door. My name is on the first sheet, with an extra flourish on the Y. She left it there so I wouldn't miss it, and my chest pounds with excitement. I grab it in record time, turning the page. Her handwriting's neat, with plenty of space between the words, and I'm grateful for that.
Once upon a time, I moved to San Francisco. My first night in town, I met a guy who reminded me of a book.
No one has ever in my whole life compared me to a book before. That's like comparing a truck to a blanket. They don't go together. With some skepticism, I flipped to the next page.
Because he fucked like a page-turner you didn't want to put down.
And I crack up. A deep belly laugh first thing in the morning. That's so her. You think she's going to say something sweet, and then it turns out she's a dirty girl. With a genuine smile, I turn one more page.
Maybe I'll see you around the city. It's big, but it's small, too. You never know. XO, Josie.
Is it just me, or does this note feel a little like a clue? Like she's a siren in a video game darting down a passageway saying, come find me. I'd follow her, I'd look for her, I'd chase her and catch her. Maybe that's what this is, a little treasure hunt, a riddle, perhaps. But that's stupid. If she wanted to get together, she'd have left her number, not a series of clues. It's fine she didn't, just fine. I take the three pages, rip them off carefully, and fold them in half, then quarters. I resume the hunt from my wallet so I can save these. Wait, where the hell is it? Did she take off with my wallet? Is that why she's gone? My skin goes cold. There's no cash, but my ID and credit cards are in there. What if last night was some long con into identity theft? You've seen too many movies, man. Or maybe not enough. My pulse spikes as I search the room, but then it slams hard against my ribcage in relief when I spot the vegan leather wallet on the floor by my side of the bed. I kneel to grab it when I catch sight of a swath of black fabric. Is that? I grab it from under the bed. I am not responsible for the smile that takes over my face. Fate is, because yeah, it's a motherfucking clue. This scarf she left. This note she wrote. This scarf is a glass slipper and I'm taking it. I know where she lives, in that yellow building on the block by the record store. I check out of the hotel and walk several blocks to my car, which is littered with tickets and I don't even care. I've got a damn good excuse to see my Cinderella again. That afternoon, I'm racking the bench press next to Asher in the Sea Dogs weight room when Max comes in, all glower and attitude. The grumpy goalie travels with his own storm cloud.
You missed last night, Newman.
He grunts as he passes me, heading for the free weights. At the start of practice today, Asher gave me a hard time for being a no-show at pool, even though I texted those jackasses last night while I was waiting for Josie outside her place. Told them I wouldn't make it. But Max is wired to give me a hard time, and to use that awful nickname. I wouldn't really say I missed it, I remark as I add one more plate. Like a dog who just heard the dinner bell, Asher sits up on his bench, pausing his preacher curls. He's suddenly more interested in a story than a workout.
You ditched us for Hannah again, Newman?
I roll my eyes. Fuck off.
Is that what you told Palmella last night?
Max goads as he grabs a couple barbells, pronouncing it like Palmella. Yes, that's exactly what happened last night. I told my hand to fuck off.
And your hand said, oh, oh, oh,
Max says, pumping his hips, because we're all immature like that. But it's also impressive he can do it while holding weights. Still, I scratch the side of my face with my middle finger, then lie on the bench, briefly flashing back to the convo with Josie last night, when I said, I work out a little. For a second, a sliver of guilt wiggles through me. Was it rude not to tell her what I do for a living? I mean, she didn't really tell me what she did. Just said she was in the book business. Probably works for a publisher or at a bookstore. But still, I talked around my job way more than she did. Was that misleading? Of course it was misleading. But was it wrong to hide it the way I did? Well, I can rectify that if she says yes when I figure out how I'll return the scarf. As I settle in and wrap my hands around the bar, I nod to Asher. Spot me, Callahan, I say using his last name, rather than his nickname, Pretty Boy. Not that it isn't fucking amusing to call him that. I'd just like them to stop calling me Newman for being the new guy.
The less I say pretty boy, maybe the more he'll call me by my last name, Bryant. Asher comes behind the bench, standing watch.
I got you, he says. He's a winger, and he's ferocious on the ice, the opposite of how he looks off it. He has the kind of smile that gets him all sorts of sponsorship deals. As Max shifts into flies, his blue eyes scan the room, clearly looking for someone. Hey, where's Winters? That's a good question. I didn't see him on the ice.
Me neither,
Asher remarks. Never misses practice, Max adds, then his brow knits, like maybe he's figured out the mystery of our missing captain, but he says nothing. I don't either as I lift the bar again.
Too bad you didn't make it last night, Newman,
Asher remarks as I lift.
Max was off his game big time. Huey and I cleaned up.
That's Hugo, one of our top defenders. I saw him earlier when I arrived, but he hit the athletic trainer's room after practice. Max scowls. It's all part of my strategy, to take you for everything next time. I scoff. Keep telling yourself that, Lambert, I say as I lift the bar one more time, my muscles straining.
So how was your night, Bryant?
Asher asks. Thank fuck we don't use nicknames all the time.
Don't tell me a miracle happened, and you actually found a woman in this city willing to sleep with your ugly ass,
Max says dryly as he sets down his weights.
Breathing out hard, I put down the bar, then sit up and meet my jackass friend's eyes. I smirk like a cocky fucker as I think of last night.
I don't kiss and tell. Asher gives me an approving look.
Nice, man.
Max just shrugs. Even a broken clock gets lucky once in a while. I laugh, shaking my head. Dude, the saying is even a broken clock is right twice a day.
That too,
he says as the slap of sneakers in the hallway grows louder. A teddy bear of a hockey player fills the doorframe.
Give it up for Daddy Winters,
Hugo calls out, then strides into the weight room, wielding his phone like it's Simba. He brings it to us and we crowd around it. There's a picture splashed across it. It's our team captain, Christian Winters, looking overjoyed as he holds two of the tiniest people I've ever seen. Holy shit, I say, smiling at the sight of one very happy new dad. That's why he's not here.
He has two little boys. Looks like we've got some sea pups,
Hugo says, and he's the softy of the bunch, probably because he's already a dad. He and his wife have a little daughter. We need to get them skates, stat, I say.
And helmets, Hugo adds.
And sticks, Max puts in.
The pucks are on me, Asher adds.
Hugo lowers his phone.
And he said he deputized me to handle any problems, so guess I'm acting team captain.
He puffs out his chest. Power-hungry teddy bear, which means we need to give him hell. Asher must feel the same way, since he shoots him a doubtful look.
Shouldn't Weston be the acting captain?
Asher asks. Weston is Chase Weston, a center and the former captain who stepped down right before I joined the team. He'd been captain for a few years, though, earning mad respect from the guys for his calm, focused, and outgoing style. But he'd said he wanted to spend more time with his wife and their dogs, which I get. If I had dogs, I'd spend as much time with them as I could, too. But it's hard when you're on the road to have a pet.
Dude, Weston said Nacho had an agility tournament. He said it like an hour ago when we left the ice,
Hugo says to Asher, shaking his head. I can see the play before the puck even comes my way. I lunge for it, clapping Asher's shoulder as I say, remember? Weston said he was taking off for the tournament, but that Winters had planned to take us all to dinner tonight, to our favorite hot pot place. Asher's eyes twinkle.
Right, that was it.
Max strides over, then in his deep voice adds,
the one in Japantown.
What a beautiful, clever bastard. That's the priciest hot pot. For team morale before a game, I add with my nice guy smile. Asher flashes Hugo a satisfied grin.
He told us to round up the other guys.
My brow pinches, like I'm momentarily confused as I ask, so that would mean dinner's on you, right, Huey? Hugo snaps his fingers.
Damn it.
When I leave that afternoon, I check my phone on the way to the players' lot. There's a message from my sister.
Natalie. Dude, you're in trouble. I heard you didn't get any artwork. How could you refuse the chance to decorate your walls with a skeleton horse?
Ah, hell. I'd nearly blocked that art gallery out of my head. I'd also gone almost a whole day without thinking about my dad. But I'm back to my meal plan, my workout routine, and everything else, which means I'd better order mushroom broth, veggies, and lean chicken tonight at Hot Pot. But really, I can't complain. Wesley, what's even more mind-boggling is that he told you. Natalie, I was caught in the crossfire when he called me today about his trip here at the end of the week when the season starts. Anyway, I think Frida was devastated that you didn't buy something from her gallery, so she gave Dad an earful and Dad gave me an earful, but enough about them. Who is the woman in the t-shirt? Wesley. Shit. She told you? Natalie. Well, she told Dad and Dad told me, and now he wants to know who you're dating. I groan as I click on my seatbelt. Of course, he'd try to get it out of Natalie first. He's not a shrewd guy for nothing. Natalie loves all things romance, so... Wesley. Is he asking to see if he thinks she'll be a distraction or an asset? Natalie. Well, it is, Dad, but this is me, and I want to know because I love you. Details. Wesley. There's not so much to tell, Natalie. Natalie. Liar. Wesley. I swear we're not dating. Natalie. Really? Frida made it seem like you guys were together? Shit. There is that issue to contend with now. The I lied to my dad's girlfriend issue. But maybe it won't be such a lie soon enough. Wesley. I'll explain it next time I see you, but trust me, we're not dating. I gotta go. She says goodbye, and I set the phone down. Then pull out of the lot while mentally revising that last statement. We're not dating yet. When I get home, I flop down on the couch, fire up my laptop, and pay my parking citations. Happily. Do I walk past Better with Pockets a couple times this week? Yeah, I do. Do I hope on some off chance I'll run into Josie there? Abso-fucking-lutely. Do I? No. I am not that lucky. But men who rely on luck don't get far in life. Dating is like hockey. You need a plan. You need a strategy. You need to know what you're doing. On Thursday, I head into a store on Fillmore Street called Effing Stuff. The place sells little tchotchkes, mugs, coasters, and magnets. I walk up to the counter where a woman with box braids and a nose ring says, "What can I help you with?" "Hey there, I need a gift bag for a girl." "A girl you like?" the woman asks. "Yes." "What's her favorite color?" "Black and white," I say, feeling a little smug that I know the answer. Hoping the answer leads me to another yes from Josie, with no last name.
Chapter 8. Cactus Attack. Josie. 3 days into my new job at a small branch of the San Francisco Public Library, and my stomach didn't growl embarrassingly during my meeting today. My teeth didn't become a net for lettuce when my new boss took me to lunch at a nearby salad bar yesterday. And I didn't trip and fall on my face, ass, or knee at all this week. Not that I am prone to those things, but I am human after all. And I've read enough books where the heroine has a very bad day during the first week on a new job and thus needs to drown her sorrows in Chardonnay and cookie dough that weekend. I'm counting the fact that I don't need a double dose of food and wine sympathy as a big win. Bonus points I'm giving myself? I didn't once try to massage the kink out of my ass, neck, or back while at work. This might be the biggest victory of all, since that loose spring in Maeve's couch is no joke. I'm so convinced it's out to get me, I've named it The Kid, as in The Kid from Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree, also known as the greatest villain in all of literature. The Kid is sharp, pointy, and merciless, and my body is paying the price. But I'm moving into my short-term rental tomorrow after work, and I refuse to complain about another night on the floor, since the kid was so vicious last night I moved to the hardwood at Maeve's, hence the migration of said kink to my back and neck. Besides, I'm all about looking on the bright side after my week kicked off with the world's greatest one-night stand. My string of good luck then continued. My new boss, Talia Rosenstein, is super cool. She told me there's a guy named the Great Grimaldi, and when he comes in to use the library's recently opened digitization center, I should jump at the chance to help him, since he's digitizing his old magic shows and you can learn the coolest things. She also spilled that Eddie, who handles the city's research collections, likes to nuke tuna fish in the microwave every day at 12:01, so the break room is best avoided then. And the rattling noise in the stairwells isn't a ghost, but a raccoon, who may or may not be living in the walls, but who occasionally has been spotted in the ladies' restroom on the third floor. Talia also set me up with real projects on my first day, not just busy work. Thanks to a newly established grant the library won from the Violet Delia Foundation for Library Digital Empowerment, I'm here at this branch in the Upper Haight on a 3-month position to work on its digitization initiatives. That includes teaching some classes to patrons on how to best use online resources and helping the public digitize their own materials, like cassette tapes, Super 8, and floppy disks. I'll also work on managing the library's existing digital collections and promoting them to the public. Since digital archives was a key focus for my master's degree, I jumped at the chance. As I'm packing up behind the second floor desk, I turn to Talia, who's taking a pile of books from the returns tray. Thanks again for the raccoon tip. I'm not sure if I want to only use the third floor restroom or never use it now, I say. I mean, raccoons can be cute. It's a real dilemma, she says dryly, then swivels away from her desktop and lifts a finger covered in silver skull rings that match the silver bracelets jangling up and down the light brown skin of her arms. How she wears bracelets and types all day is a mystery to me, but the bracelets sound like pretty bells, so I don't mind the intrigue. Oh, one more thing, Josie. On Fridays, Dolores from the children's wing brings her special brownies. I pause, digesting that nugget. When I hear special and brownies, I think of the ones some of my friends made in grad school. Special as in laced with a little something extra to make the day or night feel real chill. I arch a curious brow, but keep my tone even as I ask, special in what way? As in they're made with melted dark chocolate. Oh, that's a relief. What time do I need to be here to make sure they aren't all gone? She nods approvingly. I knew you'd understand. She looks around furtively, then whispers, 8:55. The vultures from circulation descend at 9. Also, tomorrow afternoon we have a training session on how to help people experiencing homelessness. Might last into the early evening since there are often lots of questions. I'll be there, I say, glad the library is tackling this important topic, since any library staff member these days needs to work compassionately with the unsheltered, as well as patrons with substance use disorders or mental illnesses who come through our wide-open doors. For now, though, I'm happy to leave work behind, because this little information specialist has a project and a plan for her Thursday night. After I sling my bag over my shoulder, I grab the tiny cactus I picked up last night at Welcome to the Jungle, a plant shop over on Fillmore Street run by a retired hockey star from the Sea Dogs. I smooth my free hand over my white button-down blouse, then along my black pencil skirt, and head to the circular stairway. My flats click-clack with a loud but satisfying echo through the weird little library that's quickly become my home away from home. I reach the exit, then walk past the fire station next door. Some of the guys who work here are out washing their cherry red truck. I smile a hello, and the three of them smile back. I continue on in the San Francisco evening. It's warm since it's October, but I still instinctively reach for my scarf to wrap it around my neck. But of course, it's not here. A pang of sadness hits me every time I do this phantom move. I realized when I left the hospital on Monday afternoon, after cuddling my little nephews as much as I could, that I'd probably left the accessory behind in the hotel room. But when I popped into the resort that evening to see if it was in their lost and found, the clerk checked and then frowned an apology. Sorry, Greta, I say to the sky, since that scarf was her favorite. It was the scarf I'd played dress up with as a little girl when I'd stayed with her. I'd wrap it around my head, put on her glasses, and pretend I was a granny. Or we'd dress up her rescue Labrador, turning Lulu Blossom into a cowgirl with it, or Rosie the Riveter. Scarves are the unsung heroes of the fashion world. They add personality to an outfit, they add flair, and they add a certain je ne sais quoi, Greta had said, then tucked a finger under my chin. And you, my love, are a je ne sais quoi type of person, so wear it that way. I'd like to think wearing it as a belt on Sunday night was so very je ne sais quoi. And if I had to lose the scarf, leaving it at the scene of my night in sex heaven seems the perfect place to let that part of me go. I straighten my shoulders and walk like I'm still wearing it. I'll find another one. I'll hit the thrift shops this weekend once I move into my new place. Once I'm settled, I can tackle the rest of Greta's list in earnest. I've already started researching the second item she left for me to do. Now that I've tackled the first one, it'll be easier, I think, to work my way through the list. But even though I'm researching item two, I can't stop thinking about item number one. The way Wesley touched me, the way he teased me, the way he talked to me. A hot shiver slides down my spine. And the way I see it, I was faithful to the list when I checked that first item off. It was a one-night stand with a sexy stranger through and through. Since I completed the task so perfectly, I figure I'm free and clear to see him again, not as a one-night stand. I mean, the logic holds up. That is, if I can find him again. My stomach dips with nerves and hope. I'm almost tempted to tell my mom I started doing the list her sister gave me before she died. Mom hasn't seen the list, but she knows it exists. She's asked me a few times about it. Right now, though, she's way too focused on her athlete son's babies. Understandable. Truly, it is. Though she's always been focused on him. She's a former athlete, so I get it. My dad is too. Mom played college volleyball and won an NCAA championship. And dad ran track. So they've always just had their bond with their firstborn who skated before he walked. It's fine. I'm used to it. Mom's flying in this weekend to help out for the next week. As I walk, I text Maeve since she knows about my plan to try to find Wesley tonight. Josie, I'm doing it. I'm on my way. Maeve, I know, my little tiger. My brow knits. She knows. I voice dictate my reply as I weave past early evening crowds in the Upper Haight. Josie, how do you know? Maeve, you're on the corner of Webster and Hayes. You're almost there. Damn it. I never turned off my location tracker. Maeve, also, looking at your location history, I see you went to Elodie's Chocolates today at lunch. I'm hoping you got me some. But I'm most interested in this visit you paid last night to my favorite toy store after work. I thought you were just going to the plant shop. Did you go into risque business and pick up a battery-operated gift for your girl? You holding out on me? Red splashes across my cheeks. Of course Maeve would notice that. She was the devil to my angel one Halloween in college, after all. Josie. Yes, but your toy is so big it's requiring a forklift. Hope you can carry it up the stairs. Maeve. Now that just makes me want it even more. I put the phone away and check the numbers on the storefronts. The gallery's on the next block. As I walk the final 50 feet, I steel myself. Frida didn't like me when I begged her to let me in on Sunday. There's a very good chance she won't help me tonight. A great one, in fact. But this is my only recourse. If I can convince her to give me Wesley's last name, I can track him down. The internet and me are tight, and I can find anything on it. All I need is that one tiny detail. I'm prepared, though, to bargain with the Ice Queen. I researched Frida, learned she studied art history in London. She loves fine wine. I don't have the budget for that. Fine art? Definitely don't have the budget for that. Antibes, as if, and cactus plants. Yay, plants! I picked up a tiny bunny ears cactus, and I'm hoping to use it as an apology gift. And, well, a lubricant. After all, when I first met Frida, she pretended to be someone else so as not to have to deal with me. When I arrive at the gallery, I gather my nerves and head inside the sterile place with futuristic art. My shoes clack louder than they do at the library, echoing around the white walls adorned with nightmarish visions. I'll be right there, she says warmly in a somewhat British tone from a back room. Butterflies flap in my chest as I say, thank you, as cheerily as I can. But when Frida emerges, her expression turns stony, a brow elevating in disdain as she sizes me up. I see you discovered the existence of clothing stores. I absorb the blow, deflecting it. I did. I wanted to thank you for letting me into your event the other night. Her right eye twitches, like she doesn't want to say it wasn't her choice. I do so hope you were able to locate your phone. Maybe consider a lanyard or a crossbody bag to attach it to next time. That's what parents do for young children. She offers with so much false kindness, it's as impressive as the white pantsuit with the plunging neckline that she wears. Great tip. I appreciate it, I say, trying my best to appear upbeat and undeterred. I'm here to offer a little thank you gift. You're going to buy a piece of art? How lovely. Come on now, darling. I'll show you around. Actually, I can't. Oh, why not? It's asked with so much concern. Because each piece of this horrid art is over $5,000, you snob. I don't have the budget, I say honestly, then brace myself for the toughest ask of all. It feels like scaling a 10-story wall in Louboutins. I was hoping you could give me Wesley's last name. She blinks, peering at me first with utter confusion, then villainous delight. Your date? Your plus one? The one who likes to surprise you with his fantastic date ideas, so he told you to meet him here? She parrots my words back to me so precisely that my stomach twists. I knew this wouldn't be easy. I didn't know it would be this hard, make me feel this small. But she has the moral high ground and the information, so I can't argue with her. Yes, I say, swallowing roughly. Do you think you could give me his last name? I hold out the plant in a peace offering. Do you not have it, darling? Her tone is dripping with concern. Sadly, I shake my head. I don't. Let me see if I can remember it. She sighs, taps her chin, stares at the ceiling. It's coming back to me. She lowers her face, smiles serenely, and says, his name is... I hold my breath. She's not an evil ice queen after all. She can melt. Wesley, she continues, then mimes typing on a keyboard. The guy I met at a gallery who doesn't want to see me again. There, just put it into Google, just like that. I feel 2 feet tall. Talk about a slap in the face. I'm reeling as she crosses the distance in her spiky heels, sticking out a bony hand, reaching for the plant. The bunny ears, please. Briefly, I fantasize about flicking my hair, channeling the scarf power, even though I'm not wearing it, and saying ever so coolly, you can find it online. Just search for unkillable plants that even I could kill with my bitchiness. But I don't. Instead, I yank the plant closer to my chest, spin on my heels, and get the hell out of there. Race walking away from her gallery, powered by my own frustration. It was stupid of me to think that could work, just foolish to believe I could pull off that kind of request. What's the point, anyway? Frida's smack back is probably a sign the one-night stand is supposed to stay a one-night stand. As I unleash an annoyed sigh, my phone rings. I'm reaching for it when I realize, too, that my chest feels a little strange, a bit scratchy and uncomfortable. But before I can figure out why, I check the screen. It's a 415 number from Johnson Properties. That's the place I'm moving into tomorrow. The landlord probably wants to give me the passcode or something. This is Josie, I answer. The rough, gravelly voice on the other end says,
Hey, 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 Ms. Winters. This is Barry Johnson. I have some good news and bad news. Which do you want first?
Probably a broken pipe. Possibly a toilet installed upside down. I can handle either. Bad news, of course, I say.
Cool, I'll start with the good news,
he says. Why did he even ask? Okay. Barry wastes no time.
So, it's more like world's greatest news since I just signed a sweet deal to sell this building, 10% above asking price.
This is worse than I'd imagined. I feel like I was just dropped out of a plane without a parachute. My stomach bottoms out as I say weakly, The bad news is I don't have a place to stay.
You are sharp, girlie,
he says with a whistle, like he's genuinely impressed with me adding up 2 plus 2.
But the other good news is I have a buddy, Donnie, who's got a deal for a short-term rental just for my referrals. He can lease a one-bedroom to you at a bargain.
There's hope on the horizon. Where? When can I move in? How much?
Russian Hill, Sunday, and a hell of a deal at $3,999 a month.
My eyes bug out. I can't afford that on my starting salary. I wouldn't be able to afford that for many years, if ever.
No worries. He thought you might say that. More good news is this. He's got a one-bedroom that you can share with 3 other people as long as he doesn't disclose how many are on the lease. Plus, there's a bathroom down the hall for you all to share.
I stop, lean against the wall of Better with Pockets, and close my eyes for a beat. When I open them and look down, my chest is bleeding right above the neckline of my shirt. Great. Just great. The cactus has pricked me. Thanks, Barry, but I'll have to pass, I say, then hang up. My throat tightens as my chest bleeds into my white shirt. Tears well behind my eyes. From Frida's insults to the cactus attack to the terrible news, I can't deal anymore with my upside-down luck that seems to flip-flop by the day. My eyes sting, but I suck back tears and stab my brother's name. I hate doing this. I truly do, especially now when he has his hands full. I call my brother. Christian's blue eyes are tired, but also pleased. The gold flecks in them almost seem to be twinkling, which is a weird reaction to me telling him my sob story on the back deck of his spacious home on California Street overlooking the Golden Gate Bridge as he holds Cooper while Caleb nurses inside with Liv. But I try not to read anything into his reaction. He's a new dad and is also in the starting lineup for tomorrow's season opener. He has a lot on his plate, which is why I wish I didn't have to come to him.
Don't worry, Jay, he says reassuringly. I'll help you out.
I look at him with still wet eyes. I can't believe I'm crying over a lost rental. But it's not only the rental falling through. It's how much I want this job. I'm 3 days in and I already love it. I don't want to lose it simply because I have no place to stay. Jobs like this are hard to come by. Cities like San Francisco, though, are even harder to live in. Maeve volunteered to let me stay with her, but her place is too small. And, well, the kid haunts it. So here I am, with a Band-Aid on my chest, a bloody shirt, and an attacking cactus asking my brother for help. I hate asking anyone in my family but my aunt for anything. But I have no choice.
Chapter 9. A Secret Room Under the Staircase. Wesley. The scarf and the bag is safe and sound on the back seat of my car. I've got a plan to drop it off tomorrow morning at the yellow apartment building. Saturday seems like a good day for something like that, when it's late morning and the sun is up. I can leave it in the foyer with other packages at her place. It'll be the perfect morning activity after we win tonight, since I fully plan for us to leave the ice victorious. I've been eating my quinoa and squash, been following my exercise regimen, been working on strength and conditioning all summer with a performance coach my dad hired. Hell, Dad and I met with him again today after the team's morning skate, so Dad could go over my workout routine with him for the season. This will be your breakout year, he likes to say. Let's set you up for long-term success. Translation, let's get you a no-trade clause. Hell, I'd love a no-trade clause and the security that would come with it. I thought I'd had job security in New York. My stats were solid there, where I played 4.5 years. The trade surprised me, but I rolled with it. After a strong second half of the season last year when I joined the Sea Dogs as a winger, I want to show the coach and my new team why I belong in the first line. For now, I go through my pregame rituals. I'm parked in a chair in front of my stall, taping my stick, and chilling with the guys. I've been debating with Max and Asher whether we should get tickets for the Chapel Roan concert next week, since we're all a little obsessed with her tunes, when Christian strides into the locker room, looking like he's got something on his mind. Even though he just had kids earlier in the week, he's playing on the first line for tonight's game. That shouldn't surprise me, him being here or playing well,
since I don't think he missed a game all last season. Guess he's captain for a reason. The dude shows up and plays hard. He sets an example every goddamn day. I respect the hell out of him. I want to have a career like his. Resting his arm against the stall, he clears his throat. Good news. My sons are awesome. The three of us took a pre-game nap together today. Those are a must on game days. Chase pumps a fist. Starting the hockey training from day one, he calls out from in front of his stall. Well done, winners. Christian nods and takes a deep breath. Yep, my instincts were right. He must be gearing up for a season opener speech, and when he says, "Listen, guys," I'm sure he is. I've got some more good news. He scratches a jaw overrun by a five-day growth he probably hasn't bothered to shave. Great news, actually. My sister's rental fell through, he says, and he sounds pleased in a Machiavellian way. And I couldn't be happier. Her place wasn't in a good neighborhood, he says, then names the area. I cringe. My reaction does not go unnoticed by the captain. You wouldn't want your sister staying there either. You'd only want your sister staying someplace safe, right? There's a collective yes from maybe half of us, the half of us who have sisters. Natalie and her girlfriend live in a nice place in Noe Valley, so I don't worry about her. But Riker Samuels nods toward Christian, a grim look on his face. That's why I made sure Ivy moved into my place when I moved out way back when. Well, back when she was single. Same, Hugo puts in. I always look out for my family. My point exactly, Christian says to our top defenseman. Anyway, I warned my sister against it when she rented it, and now that it's fallen through, she's finally listening to me. So she's staying with you? Max barks out from next to me as he tugs on his chest protector. Christian scoffs. Dude, no. Liv and I are just a little bit busy with the twins. We have a baby nurse staying in a guest room, and my mom is coming and staying in another room. There's no space for Jay. He points to the group of us filling the locker room. Which brings me to the great news. Which one of you guys wants to do me the biggest favor ever and let my sister stay with you for the next 3 months? I want her to live in a safe neighborhood, and I know all you assholes live in Pacific Heights or the Marina District, so that'd be perfect. She's quiet, keeps to herself, and spends most of her time reading or working. You won't even know she's there, and you'd be doing me a solid. Asher smacks my shoulder. Dude, you have that secret room, don't you? The one under the staircase, right? I laugh. Yeah, it disappears and reappears whenever you need it. Asher tips his forehead to me. Fucking Newman didn't even know when he bought the place that it had an extra room. I hold out my hands wide, shrugging like it's no big deal. When I was looking for a place to buy after I was traded, I checked out a bunch of townhomes in Pacific Heights, where most of my friends and the pro teams in the city live. Some had two bedrooms, some had three. I picked the one I liked most, barely paying attention to the details. It's an investment more than anything. Who knows how long I'm here, but I'd rather own than rent since I can. Turns out I own a three-bedroom when I'd thought it was two. But it's like finding a slice of pizza you didn't know you had left in the box. It was like a bonus room when I moved in, I say. Then I meet Christian's gaze and lift a finger. Happy to help out. Christian breathes the biggest sigh of relief. Perfect. I'll send you her contact info, Bryant. He whips his phone from his pocket. And I'll tell her I found her a place and that you'll be reaching out. He pauses, then adds, Now? As if I'd do anything else but reach out right away. Of course, I say. I already told her to come by at the end of the game so I can introduce the two of you. She has some training thing that's running late at her library. Chase whistles at Christian. You already told her to come by? Before you even asked us? Damn. The golden-haired former captain turns to the rest of us, arms out wide. That's the kind of attitude we all need to manifest on the ice. A winning attitude. He's not wrong. The rest of the guys nod in agreement, and I grab my phone and click on the contact card Christian just fired my way. Jay. I send her a quick text, then meet his eyes. Done, I say.
Suck up, Max mutters under his breath.
Christian cocks his head Max's way.
What did you say?
Max swallows, then shrugs as nonchalantly as he can.
I said, That was so nice of him to help out. I thought so, Christian says, then walks to me and offers a hand. I owe you. We shake, then he adds, just keep your hands off her. There's a collective laugh in the locker room, then a collective no shit, like I'd do anything to rock the team boat. I got you, man. We all know that rule, Asher adds. It's the golden rule of being on a team. You don't bang a teammate's sister, well, unless you plan to marry her. As Christian heads to his stall to get ready for the game, my phone pings with a text from my new roomie.
Chapter 10, My New Roomie, Josie. Is that a raccoon tapping on the bathroom door while I pee? With my luck, it'll be a ghost planning to haunt me for the next 3 months. The scratching sound feels more corporeal, though. But is there really a raccoon in the library? Well, I now know they can live in walls. That usually happens in older homes. They're resourceful little critters who shimmy into chimneys, attics, and crawl spaces. I looked them up when I heard the raccoon story from Talia. This building is modern and seems less likely for a raccoon home invasion. So that leaves me with, yep, a ghost. Of course. I pee as fast as I can, flush, and hustle to the sink to wash my hands. I need to get back to the training session anyway. Maybe Christian wrote to me. He should be at the rink by now. He said he'd be in touch before the game started, but when I turn around to check my phone as I leave, I stop in my tracks, startled. That's not a raccoon. That's a cat. A big, beautiful seal point Siamese cat. He's parked at the door, and I do mean parked. He's barn cat size, and it's like he's guarding the exit, tail swishing, big blue eyes lasered right at me. What's your name, buddy? I ask. He doesn't move, just flicks his tail and stares at me without blinking. I kinda need to get back to the meeting, I say. Yes, this is now my life, anxiously waiting to hear from my brother about a place to live while negotiating with a giant cat. The feline is impervious to my dilemma. I advance toward the door he's guarding like a sentry, but he makes no move to let me by. Am I going to have to pick him up and move him? Right as I'm contemplating my cat removal options, my phone buzzes in my skirt pocket. I grab it like it's on fire and read the new text from Christian. My shoulders relax. My whole body relaxes. Christian found someone. A guy on his team named Bryant. He's attached the contact card. Then I spot another text from a new number and name.
Bryant. Hey, Christian said you need a place to stay. I have a suite guest room under the staircase.
My heart sprints. Jay, that sounds like something out of a book. Also, thank you. I am so grateful. You won't even know I'm there.
Happy to help.
My brother said I should come by after the game and we can meet. Does that work for you?
Yep. See you then.
I'm about to slide my phone into my pocket when it pings once more.
Bryant. Also, you can move in whenever. It has sheets and pillows and stuff already. The decorator did it, not me. So it's not like it's black sheets and chrome.
I laugh at his reassurances that it's not hyper-manly, even though I wouldn't care if it was designed in every single shade of gray. Buddy, you need to move, I say, pleading with the fluffy beast with the implacable gaze. The cat refuses to budge, though, so I bend down and scoop him up. Oof, you weigh 30 pounds, I blurt out as I lift the big boy, then open the door with a pretty impressive combination of elbow and butt maneuvering, if I do say so myself. I see you met Raccoon. It's Talia on the other side, bracelets jangling as she heads my way. Raccoon? I ask. Our library cat. We found him in the wall and he stayed, but don't body shame him, she says with a wink. My bad, I say, then gesture toward the floor. Okay to put him down here? She waves her arm around to the shelves, her bracelets chiming. He has run of the place. Leave him wherever. He's why we have no mice, she says as I set him down, and in a heartbeat, he makes like a cat and hightails it far, far away from me. On my way back to the conference room, Christian sends me one more text, telling me a woman named Everly will meet me at the arena whenever I arrive. He drops me her number, too. I thank him, then return to the conference room, feeling like I can breathe easily thanks to a room under the stairs in some hockey player's home. When the session ends an hour or so later, Talia suggests we all grab a drink. Since I have time before the hockey game ends, I join them. She takes us to the Spotted Zebra, and I learn that I'm the first new librarian at this branch in years, and it's also the first time this little branch has landed a grant for any position. "You're our unicorn," Talia says. And unicorns are cool, so I say, "Achievement unlocked." When we're done, she offers to drop me off. I say yes and text Everly on the way. Once Talia reaches the rink, I thank her and hop out of her little Honda, hoisting my bag up on my shoulder as I walk toward the main doors. I pass the huge lit-up marquee for the Sea Dogs. Their mascot is a fearsome canine who looks like he can brave the icy waters of any North Sea ship. I haven't had a chance to Google this Bryant guy, but I can do that when I'm inside rather than when I'm walking outside at night. Safer that way. When I arrive at main door G, there's a tall blonde with her hair pulled back in a sleek ponytail. She's polished and put together in black slacks and a royal blue shirt, the color of the team. Her fair skin is dotted with a few freckles, and her brown eyes are warm. "You must be Christian's sister," she says, then offers me a hand. "I'm Everly. I work in publicity for the team, and he asked me to take you down to the locker room." I balk at that last word. "Oh," she says, shaking her head with an amused smile. "You probably don't want to go into the locker room." "Not with my brother there. Not with any of them there, to be honest. I love my brother, but I've never crushed on his teammates. Not in high school, not in college, and not while he's been in the pros. I'm more into geeks and nerds than athletes, so the idea of standing around a bunch of big, sweaty guys does nothing for me." "I can wait in the hall," I say helpfully. "Of course," Everly says, then whisks me past security and through the concourse. "So you just arrived in the city about a week ago," Christian tells me. "What do you think so far?" "That I never know if I'm going to step into a mud pit or a garden of flowers?" "It's great," I say, since there's no need to tell her the details about my topsy-turvy experiences here. "You never know what each day holds." "Sounds like working here. I never know if I'm going to have to wrangle a pack of ornery kangaroos or not," she says, then whispers playfully, "Usually it's ornery kangaroos." I think I love her. We speak the same language. "I hope you wear armor then. Part of the job, along with fetching sisters for the captain and, oh yeah, organizing publicity," she says as she guides me through the upper concourse, past she food vendors peddling organic and sustainably grown food, and toward the lower level. I've been here a few times, including for a game last season, but it's still helpful to have a guide so we can move quickly past the throngs of exiting fans. But tonight, the pack of kangaroos/dogs will likely be happy since the Sea Dogs beat the Coyotes. "Oh, that's great," I say. I hadn't even bothered to check the score, but that's great news for my brother and my new roomie. "Ah, and there they are," Everly says as we round the corner toward the locker room where my brother's waiting outside in his post-game suit, and he's standing next to a tall, broad, ridiculously handsome man. My heart stutters, then stops. I can't breathe. I'm a computer that just beachballed as I come face to face with the guy I tried to track down last night. "And that's Wesley Bryant," Everly says. I cough. I part my lips to try to speak, but wheeze out a question that I already know the answer to, but have to ask anyway. "Wesley Bryant?" "Yes, and he got an assist tonight, so he'll probably be in a very good mood," she says. I'm not so sure about that. When he turns toward our voices, his brown eyes lock with mine. It takes a beat for his brow to furrow. Then it goes tighter, then tighter still. When Christian sees me, he says, "Hey, Jay, here's your new roomie." Wesley's